This one. Good afternoon. Well. Good afternoon. I'm very glad we don't. I don't have to do the introduction like a Siamese twin with our speaker. So, thank you all for coming. It's good to see so many people here. We've arranged good weather for a change. But I hope you enjoyed lunch and the tour this morning. I have to keep away from the speakers, these ones. So let's get on with it. It's my pleasure to introduce the 34th Macaulay Lecture speaker, which is Professor Jackie McGlade, who's Director of the European Environment Agency. Jackie's been in that post for 7 years, 3 days,
yes,
and was renewed for 3 more years just 3 days ago, so 1st of June this year. So we're pleased she's here. Before that, Jackie was the NERC Professorial Fellow in Environmental Informatics in the Department of Mathematics at University College London, and she has a history in spatial analysis, expert systems, environmental informatics, and in the politics of environment and natural resources. And I imagine that being at the EEA, you're in that up to your neck, and it's obviously an environment you thrive in. So welcome, thank you for coming, and we look forward to your presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me to come and give this talk. What you didn't say, that I can't not stand near to the speaker. So this one's tricky, you've got to figure that one. What you didn't say was that I actually have a degree in soil science. Yes, and biochemistry, and oceanography. So, you know, I try to cover all the bases here. So I was really delighted when I saw this one come in as an invitation, and as someone who receives sort of 7 invitations to do something every day, I have to say the culling is lethal. But as soon as I saw Macaulay, I said, no, I want to go there and do that. So anyway, thank you very much for inviting me. Having been around this morning, oh, this is really not going to work, is it? Can I put this? Is that better? That's better, okay. Having been around this morning and seen the fantastic array of science and research and policy relevant work that you're doing, I quickly came back and put a few things in at the end, because when I gave the idea of this talk, I was going to really completely step out of your day job and do something very different and confront you with the idea that maybe we are in the world of not science or evidence-based policy, but policy-based evidence. And I was going to rattle your cages a bit, and I will do that. But at the end, I couldn't help but actually insert just a few more bits and pieces about the work that we're doing in the agency, which I would really like to sort of encourage you to really participate in with us. So I'm afraid I'm going to abuse my time slightly. But anyway, let me get on to the core of the talk. So it's very interesting being an observer of policy, and in some senses being embedded in the policy machinery as a scientist, and seeing actually how scientists operate in that system. And it's all boils down to the real problem, which is that scientists and policymakers actually don't cross the road to meet each other on the whole. They try to avoid each other. And yet policymakers want always to say evidence-based policy is what we do. And scientists usually think that if their science is to be used by policymakers, it has to be done at arm's length. This, I would call almost a pseudo-sense of independence, is something which is held dearly to the hearts of many scientists. But actually, the reality is something very, very different. And I see it every day, I see how it operates. And I'll just give you one insight at the beginning, and then you'll see pretty much where I'm coming from. So I speak a lot to parliamentarians, of course. And recently I was at a meeting about science and trying to make the step towards policy. And the politicians on the panel said, you know, every single day through our doors come lobbyists, trade associations, industry, I mean, you name it, they're in my office. The people I never see are the scientists. And actually, I think this is where, you know, the parting of the seas comes, because there are some scientists who would not be want to be seen dead in the room or the office of a parliamentarian, because they would somehow think this was compromising their independence. And on the other hand, that's precisely what parliamentarians don't hear, is actually from the scientists themselves directly. So there is a kind of bit of a gap in the machinery, and it gets filled, I can absolutely tell you, by lobbyists who are not always, I would say, free of vested interests. So let me just tell you a little bit about that. We have a great history of science telling us about all the wonderful things. And of course, you know, I'm going to go a little bit back into a whole variety of areas. And one of them, of course, was the great thing about x-rays. And dentists and many, many other people were using it. And this was absolutely fantastic. But how many of you remember going into shoe shops in about the 50s and 60s? You know, the clerks, get your foot in there, look at your toes, wiggle your toes and all that. And of course, you know, we now know that doing x-rays and that intensity with young children is not a good thing. So it took a little while for the science to come in, but there were an awful lot of shoe shops that had the machines that kept them going for an awful long time afterwards. Mobile phones. Those of you who watch the headlines will know that a large study called the Interphone study has finally come out. The work was actually completed 4 years ago. Behind the scenes, there were huge rows amongst the various parties. 19 countries participated. Thousands of scientific hours were put into analyzing as to whether or not mobile phones cause brain tumors. And there are two camps, I'll be very honest. There's the mobile phone camp and all of its researchers, which pretty much say that despite thousands and thousands of studies, there is no evidence of brain tumors being associated with mobile telephones. And on the other side, there are a growing group of scientists, primarily in the cancer world, but also some biochemists, who are bringing more and more evidence to bear that shows that there is the beginning of signs that there is a relationship and that there is a prevalence, particularly in young children now, to show certain gliomas and other tumors. Why do these two groups, so to speak, kind of coexist? Well, actually, it's because they fundamentally believe in two different paradigms. The mobile phone companies and their scientists believe in the thermal paradigm, that actually all that phones do is heat your brain up a bit, and when you take the phone away, it cools down. But another group are working on the fact this is a bloody great big piece of radio frequency right next to your head. And what do cells do? Well, they communicate, actually, on very, very tiny amounts of interference and radio frequency. So essentially, what you're doing is distorting that. If you do that for long enough, you might actually change the cellular processes. And so they have slowly, slowly, slowly built up experiments and evidence. So this Interphone study contained both. So although the work was completed 4 years ago, it's taken that amount of time to come out with a study. And it's been reported completely differently across the press. Here it was, there is no evidence. In France, it was sufficiently strong for the French government to now ban telephones for young children, and so on and so forth. So it's been received differentially all over the world. In the USA, there are some states that have now put in place legislation, and there are other states that don't. So where's the science in that? It's completely interpreted in different ways. It's totally different science. You can put the same body of evidence on the table, and you can walk out of the room with totally different views. And this will be the kind of motive that I'm going to talk about again and again, about how careful we have to be, how we articulate the evidence, but even more importantly, how we articulate who has collected the evidence and whether there are not vested interests, even in the best of scientists who have pet paradigms that they've built their careers on, and the last thing they want to do is actually give up on that particular scientific paradigm. We are littered, I have to say, with stories of this. Alice is a very, very famous story in public health around asbestos, where, of course, it was seen to be the fabric of life. We could build everything out of it. I think you had an asbestos building here, which was demolished, so I'm sure that you took great care. And the idea then was we had a long period where it was seen as the wonder building material, but then, of course, public health came in, and there was massive campaigns, and of course now we have huge numbers of court cases where in fact people are able to claim against the harm that's been caused to them. So this has been campaigned and so on. The sad thing about asbestos and asbestosis was in fact that the research was never really undertaken in the public institutions, it was actually undertaken through charities. So again, there's another group of scientists who play into this pool of evidence who don't always necessarily come without a vested interest, because clearly they're trying to look after the rights of patients. So even though in the end, this particular group were proven to be correct, you still have to at the very beginning ask, what's the basis upon which they're generating their experimental evidence? And of course, CFCs. That's a long-standing story in the environment community that the Montreal Protocol was one of the great successes in environmental governance. But actually, DuPont had, even at that moment, developed alternatives. So they were quite happy for the Montreal Protocol to go through. And the question then is, why didn't they release those alternatives if they actually knew the damage and the harm that CFCs could cause? Well, when you read the transcripts and when you read the company reports, it isn't that they weren't potentially aware of it, but what they hadn't understood was the scale. And it was really only when the hole in the ozone layer came up that, of course, people really understood the global nature of the CFCs. So perfectly good science, not scaled up in this particular case, and therefore not really put to the test as to whether we should or should not ban CFCs. Now, in the agency, we've had a number of years of working on these ideas, ranging from precaution to late lessons, in other words, looking backwards in asbestos, in lead, many, many other issues, endocrine disruptors, TBT, and so on, and really looking at how much of the scientific evidence was there, but we just didn't get the signals. We didn't really understand the warnings that were there until too late. And in fact, we have a second volume coming out next year, which really takes on some of those cases and sees where they've gone in the meantime, so GM and a number of other issues as well. Now, let me go very quickly to climate change, because I think this is probably the one most in our minds about how science, having done its very best, seems to have got caught up in the whole issue around COP15 and the couple of months following that. So I'll just give you a quick perspective on climate change as seen from government's point of view and from NGOs and others who were really involved in the meeting. So of course, many people said that COP15 was a failure. It didn't produce a legally binding agreement, and so on and so forth. And the current pledges obviously fell far short of what we need. But the other side of it is that actually the science, when we left Copenhagen, was very, very well accepted by the vast majority of people in the room. However, the accord had some very, very positive things within it. And what it also had was a huge engagement across society. So now it was no longer just governments talking to each other and a bunch of scientists. It was actually pretty much across the board a very broad stakeholder process. So young people, businesses, and so on. And of course, that's really a problem. If you really see that your business might be at stake, then you don't really want the accord to be successful, because it might require you to change your business model rather too quickly. So whilst the optimism has been building up in the back and the science was kind of building up, we have an IPCC number 5 coming along, in the background, there was the sense of, okay, well, maybe we've got to change the way in which we do the negotiations. It's too complicated, so maybe we're going to parcel it up. Maybe what we need to do is rethink this, because this is the policy world in which the science is embedded. So you've got G20, G8, G2, different kinds of G8s. You've got, obviously, the OECD combinations and. So you've got a whole bunch of people who are all busily working away. And up there, you can see science in the little green arrow. And it'll appear again in a sort of couple of years. So, you know, it's a tiny bit of this enormous fabric of who's talking to whom and how all these different reviews are going on. So it's no wonder, in a way, that it could be crowded out, but it's a miracle in some senses that it wasn't. However, when it comes to vested interests, it's amazing how people can reinterpret and do an awful lot with data. So if you take this normal kind of looking graph that we all know very, very well, and you talk about the fact that in the last 10,000 years is where we've had a lot of stability, and in fact that's really where we're concentrating pretty much today's civilization, and the fact the temperature hasn't fluctuated by more than 1 degree, you can tell a very, very persuasive story and with a lot of scientific evidence behind it. And in fact, you know, you can even take that longer view, and we've got really high pedigree science. The question is, why is it then that within a very short period of time you have the combination of criticism around, well, are the data about glaciers really true? Was this properly peer-reviewed? Leading to, well, maybe the ice sheets aren't melting as quickly as the scientists say, even though we have measurements actually out there on the ice cap, bringing data back in from the field. And even though the IPCC said IPCC, even though it gives very strong advice to the scientists involved in its processes about, you know, be careful, don't just converge on views, make sure, you know, you're evaluating the science carefully every single time. And even though we had criteria for uncertainty, this in a way made, I think, scientists less vigilant than they should have been at that moment. Now, what happened after that, of course, is well known to us. But let me just sneak in another graph, because one of the big challenges for the whole of the IPCC work has been that politically we've tied ourselves to the model outputs. And I can't imagine that some of you won't have been watching the discussions in the journals and out in the wild, so to speak, around the fact that the models we have are really only self-referencing. The fact that everyone's very proud of them, the fact that they're all going up in the same direction, fails to admit to the fact that we have very few in-situ observations actually checking the models. So then along comes the Global Carbon Project and plonks some dots on the picture, and you can see the red dots, and they're all outside the model outcomes. So we're already in big trouble with the first sets of observations. So this was another reality, another scientific community putting their observations on the table compared to the modeling community, who had by now persuaded 158 governments, plus 20 in the margins, to commit to keeping ourselves below the 2 degrees with the effect of saying it's about 485 parts per million of CO2 equivalents. So here's a very, very persuasive set of arguments scientifically, but actually not grounded in that much in situ observation. Now, what do you do? You're sitting on some carbon data that's a little bit more extreme than all the models. What do? You wave your hands? Do you worry that you might have to have some more data? Because now, don't forget that the model community and the people who've written the IPCC, they number in the thousands, and the GCP number in the tens. Okay, so now you have really to be very careful about who and how and the burden, the balance of science as it comes in. Because there's now a huge vested interest not actually wanting to contemplate the upper one of those curves, but with a whole political machinery actually orientated to the middle curve and saying that's about all we can manage. We can't actually change our economies any quicker. So what do you get? Well, here's one example from the tobacco industry. And it was very, very effective. Those of you who know the Philip Morris case will be aware that even till now, I suspect that they still have marketing rhetoric that tells you that you could probably smoke every day until you die. When that is. But what they did was, they started back in the 60s on the basis of this internal memo. And I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you that many, many, many of the PR and other companies who were in the business back then are now in the business of working with our colleagues in the climate skeptic groups. And what they work on is this idea of doubt. They work on the idea of uncertainty, which we are all very happy with in the scientific community, but of course, one of the things that you have to be careful about talking to politicians is just how much doubt and uncertainty they can really absorb. Because in the end, they have to make a decision to do something about a particular problem. So in the late lessons, one of the things we are doing is tracking those companies that have perpetuated the concept that one of the ways to get your way in legislation is to cast doubt on the other side. And if it's scientists, you actually play on the fact that we are trying to be scrupulous about the amount of uncertainty there is in our estimates and in our models and in our experiments. But of course, that's played back against us. I don't know if any of you read the Science magazine on the 7th of May. I happen to have it here with me. There was an article, it was a letter. And it was signed by an enormous number of scientists from the National Academy. And effectively, it was entitled, as I've got there, Climate Change and the Integrity of Science. Oh, I've got it here somewhere anyway. So it's a big, big, long list of people who've signed it. And essentially what they're saying is, we don't like getting picked on. We're deeply disturbed by the recent escalation. So it turned out that when the issues at University of East Anglia came out, that was just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, over many, many years, scientists in the climate community had been receiving threatening emails and a whole range of things, had their grants squashed and so on, but had actually not made this particularly public. Steve Schneider, there was a whole range of them who had. But of course, the UEA situation, whether you approve or not of the way in which certain individuals talk about others, what it did was it made a lot of individuals who were made to feel that they were in the minority or at least vulnerable by the big corporations and others, or by funding agencies as well, I have to say, it made them essentially come out into the open. So this letter is actually quite interesting because only 4 months earlier, we had 170 states actually agreeing that the science was okay, was right, was enough to make a big global commitment to change the whole global economy. And yet within 4 months, we discover that, well, actually, the science is under attack. Every single part of that science was under attack. So it's worth thinking about how secure are we, even in the things that we believe that we've sort of left behind and we've moved on to the next step. Well, lobbying is a very, very powerful force. Same with this idea of safe margins. There's been a paper in, or an opinion piece in Nature called Planetary Boundaries. I'm sure many of you have read it. I'll disclose my opinion now. I think it's absolute rubbish, but anyway, except in two counts. But the point is that it has actually resonated with policymakers, and I'm forever being asked, well, shouldn't we just set targets on these planetary boundaries? Now, they set planetary boundaries on nitrates, on water consumption, on biodiversity, and so on. And I think these are not appropriate at the global level, and I think we should be talking about what happens locally and contextually. But immediately, we can already see in the sort of the phrasing of the way in which many, many people who've got other vested interests are saying, oh, we're operating within the safe margins of the planet. Now, that is totally untestable. Because as you, I think you pointed out, I was talking to someone on the hydrology side, micro dams. As someone said, you know, you can put a small micro, you can put a dam here and one there and one there. It's only when you stand back and add them all up that you might actually see what the larger effect is. And this is precisely what's happening now, is that we're having a lot of kind of rhetoric around, oh no, but we're helping you maintain yourself within the safe margins of the planet. So when we look at things like tipping points and as I say, planetary boundaries and within the safe margins, it's extremely important that we actually understand what the spatial scale of those is, how relevant it is to what we're doing elsewhere, the causal linkages, and precisely what it is that the science is that gives us the evidence to be able to talk about these rather more, I would say, emotive parts of the dialogue that's going on today. Another one that I find also, on the one hand, compelling is to do with population growth. I suspect that pretty much all of you are aware that we are going to have 9 billion people on this planet by 2050. Okay, who says we're going to have 9 billion people? Well, actually, a small group of people have decided we're going to have 9 billion people on the planet. It's not the 8.99999 billion of us, it's a small group. Now, if you actually go back to find out where those numbers come from, they don't come from an independent body. They come from, believe it or not, the agricultural industry. And I did some research to find out how these numbers actually came up. And it was work that was funded, which was undertaken by IFPRI and others in the food sector and in the agricultural sector, seemingly actually that it was being done independently. But the ramifications of that number are absolutely enormous, because what has happened is that we've now tagged pretty much everything to this. Our energy consumption and where it's going to be. The fact that Monsanto and others used that number to say that, and the chief scientist, that unless we have GM technology, we're not going to be able to feed everybody, and so on and so on. The international agricultural assessment that was completed. Now, if you were there in the room, you would know that there was a sort of a stampede for the door when it became pretty obvious that Monsanto and others were involved and were funding part of this study. But nevertheless, there was no way for that to become transparent without it becoming utterly acrimonious. So, you know, I'm putting a big warning sign on that number called 9 billion people by 2050, if only because if you ratchet back and say, well, why do we have that number? And ask a fundamental question of Africa and say, well, what's the evidence that education and women actually works to reduce population size. And there's very strong evidence that that does work, particularly in Africa. And if you then add to that access to energy, so that women can then actually make more time available, for example, to become educated sufficiently to be employed, then you actually start to see a completely different number emerging. And there are groups that are looking at that. And then it comes down to about 7.2 billion. That's a totally different number. Now, I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong. What I am saying, though, is that if you get too quickly wedded to one or other of these paradigms without really looking at the evidence behind it, then we find ourselves in this escalation of numbers into what are global strategies, which are taking us more and more into this hypospheric world of, my God, we're not going to be able to feed everybody, then we've got to have a technology, we've got to have the water, oh my God, and it all just gets completely hyperinflated. So again, I think it's incredibly important that we look again and again and again at these large numbers and some of the assessments that are done on the basis of them. Same with energy. Oil is a real problem. I'm sure that the peak oil discussion will be even more intense now, given how much is now floating around in the Gulf of Mexico. I feel really sorry for Tony Hayward, I must say. I saw his picture on the front of the newspaper this morning and I thought, God, it must be so, the whole world, you know, he must be the figure that the whole world is got little pins in. But anyway, this is a rush hour in Beijing. I always think it's an amazing photograph. I mean, you know, you should never complain about rush hour when you think about this, I think. One funny story. I put this up to the Transport Committee in the Parliament in Europe, and immediately there was a yes from the audience. And guess who it was? It was the Truckers Association. They said, look, there's only one truck in that. There's only one in the whole of that traffic jam. So, because they're always being accused of causing all the problems for pollution. So they always take every opportunity. So again, if you talk to analysts in the oil business, in the energy business, and you actually look at the reality of what's happening, for example, in Europe, you see a completely different story. So we've just released the greenhouse gas inventory for the emissions inventory yesterday for Europe for 2008 and going into 2009. So these are, you know, poured over numbers by, they're audited by everybody around the world. Every number is checked. And it's fascinating because what you see, of course, are that emissions are coming down. And everyone says, oh, that's the recession. Actually, it turns out it isn't. There are significant shifts in the structure of our energy system inside Europe. Not just efficiency gains, but switches to gas, coming away from coal. There's a lot more renewable going into the grid in Europe than before, and so on. So when you look at the detail of the numbers, actually it's a pretty optimistic story. But I can tell you that now, today, it's being debated as the only reason the emissions are going down is because of the recession, and when business as usual picks up again, it'll all be, you know, going up again. And the reason it's important is because of the biofuels target. Now, this really was my true example of policy-based evidence. So you have a whole bunch of heads of state who are sitting in a room who want to make a decision. They really want to make a decision. They want to be seen to be doing something, you see? So they've got the 2020 targets, you know, 20% renewables and so on by the year 2020. And then somebody says, oh, but what about biofuels? And they said, yeah, that's good, because that's bio, and that's fuel, that's good. How much? What do you reckon? 10%? No, that's too much. 5%? 3? Okay. I'm not joking, that is actually how it came about. All right, so now, so it's really, you know, unintended consequences? Absolutely. But at least they had the guts to admit to it. And I think within 6 months, pretty much every politician had realized that the unintended consequences were far out of proportion to what the benefits would be within Europe. But it left us with a very interesting problem, because we then went out and said, well, if you now have bound this into law, how are you going to do it without compromising the environment? And it does turn out that if you run Europe as a whole and not as individual nation states, you can actually do it without compromising the environment. So that was an interesting proposal to the countries. Drop the nation state and then it'll all be fine. But I don't think they're going to go for that one. So they're all struggling on the 3%. Okay, so we're in a rather unstable world. There's evidence coming in from every single corner. You know, you've got NGOs, you've got scientists, you've got different kinds of scientists, you've got different organizations, all pumping information into the system. And actually, it's really difficult to figure out where and how the vested interests lie, because people don't disclose it. And at the same time, you can't rely anymore on peer-reviewed literature. Because there have been some very, very, I would think, harsh analyses that have come out. The National Academy and a couple others have done this. And of course, what they find, if you do these networks of scientists, is of course the self-citation and the group citation process. And once a group gets hold of the Science Citation Index, it basically takes you 20 years to break it. It's a phenomenally powerful process inside science. You know, if you're in the lab of the person that publishes, then you basically are in the kind of heritage and legacy and process. So in theoretical physics, they've seen it. It's happened again and again. It's happened in chemistry. And I suspect it's happening in ecology and in environmental sciences as well. So I'll just leave that with you. And just I'll leave it with you as to who's in charge of the Royal Society and all of that. OK, so that's just that one. And it's the same in every country, I can tell you. We are also faced with the fact that we've got an unstoppable regime when it comes to people using resources. And what people are looking for is, for example, labeling. Now, eco-labeling, I'm sure that most of you will have run into this at one point or another thinking, what on earth does that mean? Just to put your mind at rest, there are 365 different eco-labels in Europe today. And they all mean different things. And of course, the union is trying very hard to sort of bring them together so they do actually have some meaning. And in some areas, it's working very well. But we do have, again, a plethora of ways in which scientists are trying to persuade the consumer that they have the answer. So water footprinting, ecological footprinting, carbon, zero carbon, you know, you name it, there's a label for it, energy efficiency and so on. Very few of them talk about, beyond the recycling of plastics, the things that are actually in most of the things we value, like telephones. And I can tell you that if you were really, really worried, you'd be looking for a label that talks about how much of that telephone is recycled, because we will run into trouble for the virgin resources that go in because of some of the rare earths. So in fact, the things that are really worrying, we're not getting information on. The things that we actually couldn't care less about, we get loads of information about. And this is really, again, a problem of we're getting too much about nothing and not enough about the things that really matter. I like to use this because this is a kind of symptom of where we are. So here's a nice family in the United Kingdom. Apologies to somebody who was in one of my lectures a couple of weeks ago in Edinburgh, but I love it anyway. So the dog's doing very well. You know, he's got at least a half of the table and looking very sprightly on it. But compare this to the family over in Ecuador, much healthier, of course. They're all smiling. Do you notice? They're all happy, and there's an awful lot of them as well. So. Again, it's this idea of what are we informed about? Where's the evidence? What's the sort of scientific basis? Now, in this country, particularly, we have a food standards agency that is convinced that organic produce is no better or no worse than non-organic. But in Germany, I can absolutely assure you the opposite is true, and in France. And in Denmark as well now. So it's very interesting that on the same body of evidence, because they do share evidence, that when it comes to the consumerist aspects, you get fundamentally different things from the national relevant bodies. Now, again, I come back again to who makes those decisions. And at the end of the day, even as a European, I would kind of like to know that there's some consensus around this. Because I feel a bit uncomfortable that it's okay to be told one thing in one country, but if I go to another one, you know, I'm eating something hazardous. So I think it's actually very important that these harmonized pictures really are worked on very carefully. As part of a study called The Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, Pavan Sukhdev, who's the study leader, continues to come back to this idea about the economic compass is faulty. And I like it because, in fact, I even think that what Pavan, I mean, I'm on the panel, but I have a divergence of opinion here, because one of the things that they're promoting is the idea that we can value ecosystems in a monetary way. And I do fundamentally think that there's a problem on trying to do that everywhere. So I think the economic compass is faulty, but it's faulty for several reasons. One is that yes, of course, it's about making money from money, but it's the overconsumption and the capital destruction that I think is the most critical. And not being aware of that means, in principle, we haven't got the scientific evidence in our at our fingers to do that. And as you know, Nick Stern said the same thing about climate change. You know, the market failures are all around us. So let me go to, you know, how do we green the brown economy? What's the kind of evidence that we've got to put together? And who's going to participate in creating that scientific evidence? Well, there's going to be a whole bunch of people who are going to be down at the household level, because households are the biggest emitters of greenhouse gas. They're the largest now source of waste, and so on and so forth. So the classic example is when we removed incandescent light bulbs from the shops. And I can't tell you how much science went into this. A lot. No, that's not entirely true. Of course, Philips and others did the work. But actually, there was very little science on this one. This was simply a very short report that talked about incandescent lights and light bulbs. And if you took that and multiplied it by however many they thought there were in the households of the whole of Europe, and then you compared it to what's on the right-hand side and did the calculation, you got a big number. And as we were searching for every single crevice to get big numbers to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Europe, this seemed like the one to go for. Okay, so not a lot of science, a very unpopular policy, but as you find little old ladies reaching to the top shelf to get the last incandescent light bulb off there, you know that actually it's really had an effect. You know that that this is a policy that bit in very hard, very quickly, and but didn't have so much science behind it. But it was by the power of numbers that this one worked. So now let's just think about the three kind of crises we're living in. We've got the financial crisis, where we know there was almost too much evidence kept back from the vast proportion of people. We know that in energy and climate, as I've explained, there's been an enormous amount of evidence gathered, and now... sorry, I don't know how to do this. Would you like me to take it off, or hold it, or what shall I do? Shall I do that? That's better. Okay, I'll just hold it here, that's fine. I'm not moving, I promise you. I'm not moving anywhere near that speaker. I can feel it right up there. Okay, let me try this. But what we don't hear about is the fundamental crisis of our resources. So you read the newspapers and you see about the financial crisis, you read about the energy crisis. Do we ever read about the ecosystems that are being overexploited, about the natural capital that's being overused? No, I don't see any headlines on that at all. We also have, because of what's happened, a crisis around trust, and in the end, a crisis around governance. And the one, in fact, they're all interconnected. But the crucial one for science is that we are not really getting the right stories and the right science through to really, in a way, convince people that most of this, most of the problems that we have today is because we're overusing our resources. And I think part of the issue is that we've never really faced up to the fact that, although the economists are now beginning to talk like this, and environmentalists have for many times, they've never really seen that pretty much all of the different capitals are utterly embedded in natural capital. So what's the science of natural capital that we need to articulate to be persuasive to economies, to companies and others, to stop them lobbying against what is effectively a pretty serious condition that we're in, and actually get them to take on board that good and innovative means are actually going to make us have a more sustainable economy in the long run? Well, if you go through and actually analyze the features of these different crises, you can see that across the board, you know, financial, climate and all of them, they're all destroying various forms of capital. They're passing on the risks and debts. We're beginning to gather knowledge about that. Prices are not well covered because we don't have the economics or the pricing mechanisms or the valuation mechanisms in place. Early warnings are not heeded. And in the end, what we have is a whole bunch of intransparent transactions. So I think from a scientific point of view, we really have to understand that if we want to maintain natural capital, we're going to have to put our differences behind us. We're going to have to get a lot of people together, have to think very imaginatively. And we have to also believe that science isn't just in the domain of institutions. Actually, it's in the social capital of society. It's about saying that who and those who are experiencing the beyond GDP calculations, in other words, happiness and all the other things, have got just as much in some senses to say, but they may not have the language to articulate it. Now, when we come back to then, how do we look after the natural capitals? The thing about good governance is that you really do focus on the idea of public participation, citizen science, professionals who are in their own right able to comment and to participate, and actually really looking at these choices about balancing resource consumption and meeting the needs of tomorrow's generation, people speaking up for the next generation as well. There is, in the scientific community and in others, particularly in the civil service, a sense of equality and inequality. But it's a flawed sense, because actually it turns out that within every one of those groups, there are individuals who are better off than others, of course, but it comes from the connectedness that they feel that they live within. So there was a very important study, the Whitehall study, done by Michael Marmot at UCL. And he published these very easy to read books about it. And what he showed was that in the civil service, you have salami slicing of grades and responsibilities. And every one of those makes a difference, to the point where you could be marginally separated in salary, but actually feel that you were way down in the hierarchy compared to where you really were. He then went on to go and look at other organizations and other structures and found, quite honestly, that there's no relationship between GDP and life expectancy. So in fact, there is no, and this is across the world, there is no direct connection between it. But that your status and your ability to live a long life has more to do with your connectedness. So if you're the chairwoman of the knitting club and you meet your colleagues and you knit regularly with people every week, you are much more likely to live a longer life than the single banker and trader living in Canary Wharf and going back to his flat with £1 million in his bank account. Now, bring that back into science and bring that to what I said about clinging to paradigms and networks of scientists who basically dominate the science and the way in which we see publishing circles going round and round. Okay, it's pretty obvious. You know, you like being in a network, you like being with friends. It's good to cite, and it's good to cite your friends. So who's going to rock the boat? You're not going to be very happy if a minority scientist comes up with another view, and you're not going to be very welcoming. And so we have a real difficulty now, I think, in science, because it means often that we have a sort of an imbalance in the way in which the kind of public participation, the regulation of government, how businesses are regulated, and how the public sees well-being really being dealt with. Now, this is a kind of proposal. I have to tell you that in today's world, you can pretty much drop the top one, because the public don't actually get involved. There's a pseudoscience of consultation, but it really isn't very effective, and I'll give you one example. So we have a very skewed picture at the moment, where the public really isn't participating. On the whole, if you're in, well, as we were in the previous government, it's skewed over there, and of course now presumably it's going to be whizzing over to the left at this point. But a classic example of public participation is in seal hunting. So there was a huge debate about seal hunting in Europe, and the Commission dutifully carried out a consultation. Now remember, seal hunting is done mostly by indigenous peoples, and they rely on it in some cases for their well-being. The estimates that the indigenous people have of the seal populations and also polar bears in Earth is somewhat higher than the government scientists. So this is why we even have a consultation, because government scientists have said these are mammals that are at risk and therefore we have to stop hunting them. So the consultation goes out and the results come in. Oh, it's quite interesting. 70,000 people responded. Sounds pretty good. 64,000 of them were against seal hunting. Ipso facto, the EU bans seal hunting in the Arctic with provisions for indigenous peoples, but only for their own consumption, not to sell any products, not to make anything from them. Now let's look behind the scenes. 70,000. Well, it was a consultation done electronically, and it was done in English. Now, I don't know many seal hunters living in East Greenland who have access to internet when they're out on their dog sled, and actually they don't speak English anyway. They probably speak Danish. And 64,000 of the responses had exactly the same words. So it was a campaign that got hit. And yet, still, we considered that it was considered to be an exemplary consultation to the public. I won't say anything about the ones that are going on now in GM. So we have to be very careful about that governance model. And I think we really need to go back and look at how the public are involved in the business of creating evidence. And I include in that farmers, I include in that a whole range of people who are dealing with the substance of the matter. These are a couple of things I just want to leave with you. Perils of the precy. I'm sure every one of you have written a summary of a scientific paper and submitted it, and you've been really pissed off about how many words you can have in that. But when you look at the precy of very important reports and risk assessments, what you often see is a watering down of some of the data that exists back in the paper. And so often, policymakers only read the summary, and they never read the paper. And therefore, we have a number of policies in this arena where actually you can absolutely tell that it was only the summary that was read by the policymakers. We don't have, apart from the IPCC, a strength of evidence, a terminology. So, you know, we have some statistics, but this is more than statistics now. We're talking about burdens of evidence, as we might do in a court case. We're not very good at communicating uncertainty, and we're certainly not very good at communicating how we evaluate evidence. So here's a few that are out there. Beyond all reasonable doubt, used in the criminal courts. Reasonable certainty, used in IPCC, and so on and so forth. So we are trying to grapple with the strength of the scientific evidence. But how would you take pertinent information? It's tricky. Scientific suspicion of risk. You know, these are very interesting words that are used to try to convey how strong the evidence really has been to make a particular policy work. We also have a lot of competing ideas. I like this picture because it sort of reminds me of, you know, the real world of motoring, and all the dials mean something to somebody. I love it. I think it's just great. Unfortunately, what most policymakers want is the Porsche version. It kind of tells you the same things. And I'm not entirely convinced that even some of these aren't redundant. So there's this kind of sense of streamlining. But, you know, the world as we know it and the world as the policymaker knows it, slightly different. So be careful, is what we have to say, is be careful how you go from the one version to the next. Scientific paradigms, you know, they're loaded up with vested interests. And, you know, I love this one. Eventually people die. I watch the obituary column often. Be aware of these kinds of phrases, or use them yourself, but understand what you mean with cause and effect, suspicion, that indications, tempting to suggest that has been shown to. Okay, so again, language is very, very critical here. And intellectual bias. This is probably one of the most important cases that went through in the World Trade Organization in terms of science. So the European Community alleges, and this is its scientific panel, that the panel disregarded its most important objection. Now, these two scientists, they participated in a very critical report about beef hormones, and they said that they could not be independent and impartial because they were asked to evaluate the risk assessments that were very critical of their own reports. So, of course, you're not going to say, oh, that was a good report that criticized me. No. The point was that the European Community actually, for once, in a way, did the right thing. They realized that they had appointed the wrong independent people on the panel because they had a vested interest in not getting the answer. And they were brave enough to do it. And beef hormones, as you know, was a big, big thing. So let me finally end by minority views. Science doesn't need a majority view. I'm sure Einstein wasn't in the majority when he woke up on the day to write the famous equation. So, you know, we have to be very careful and vigilant not to really marginalize and pick on individual scientists who may be onto something. And we need much better ways of dealing with minority and divergent views and not just simply allowing the media to take them over. Now, of course, we can get it wrong. MMR, the flu epidemic in the 50s, there are a number of places where we have got it wrong. But if you apply the precautionary principle, false positives are very, very small in number compared to the whole range of things that we look at. So on the whole, it's actually better. And this is very important. This is a phrase that is continuously used now that I get extremely worried about. The absence of evidence is not evidence of harm. Oh, I missed a not. Absence of evidence is not not evidence of harm. Yes, that's it. That's the way around. Sorry, I missed one out. And this is this real problem now, because we have this mixture of cause and effects, strength of evidence, used in different ways in the medical world, in the environmental world, and elsewhere. So, a point of concern. And again, whole range of committees, scientific committees, using different phrases about uncertainty in many, many different cases where we know that there's high uncertainty, but not either admitting to it or admitting to it and saying, well, actually, in the text, you read one thing, and in the concluding section, the summary, you read something else. There are funding biases. If you read, of course, about Galileo, the Vatican went out to try and actually pay scientists to disprove him. But in this Late Lessons volume that we will bring out in the last one, you see it again and again and again, that scientists who are in the minority have their funding cut off, they are marginalized and taken out of basically respectable work, and yet some of their counterparts, and we've seen this now in a number of instances, where the funding of, for example, BPA, bisphenol A and others, funded by national research bodies, even though we know the evidence has been stacking up to the contrary, continues to plough certain ways to enhance its use. So there's real dangers here that even the funding biases are to be watched. We don't have very good risk assessments. I'll leave that with you. But essentially, what we're proposing now, my agency and agencies across Europe, is that we really need to have a more formal way of bringing evidence in. And it really has to be done by organizations or agencies that have the public good at their heart, so they should be public institutions, but they should have explicitly no vested interest. And it is possible, it is actually possible to constitute this, but it's also possible to hold what we see in the court cases, a dialogue which can be real. Now, I put this up because last week now, this letter went public. And this is to John Curtis, as you can see, from the Food Standards Agency, who are running a GM dialogue. And now more than one person has resigned from the committee. And I only raise this because this is now out in the public domain. But effectively, you might say, well, Gene Watch is a sort of an extreme group. But in the dialogue, this is the point. They have evidence from their community that talks about the concerns in the GM world, the non-GM crops and the GM food and all of that. And the fundamental point that this group now are raising, the ones who have resigned, is that the predisposition in the committee before the dialogue began was that, and I go back to my numbers, 9 billion people on the planet, we won't be able to feed them, therefore we need GM crops. And the reason why they say that authoritatively is because in the call for tender for the company to run the dialogue, that was explicitly in the text of the call. So there was a predisposition to find the answer before it actually was concluded. I use this as one example because genuinely I think the UK government did get its fingers burnt the last time around, and I really hope this time around they would have learned. But as you can see, it's not going to be the case. And I think this will be very contentious. Germany and Austria and other countries are running dialogues in a very different way, in a very, I would say, constructive way. And I think there's much to be learnt about how you open the doors to different groups to bring evidence in. And the main difference is that they're bringing a lot more farmers from all over the world who have experience of growing the crops and actually listening and taking evidence from them. And I think this is, again, about who's in the dialogue and how do you constitute what is a proper governance of gathering evidence for very, very contentious issues. So, I said I was going to abuse my time. Can I have 4 more minutes? Can I? Okay, thank you. I don't normally do that, but you're just such a great group of people. Now that's the lecture over. Now I want to tell you about some other things. Okay, so leading the way. I'm hoping that all of you have heard about SICE, but I doubt you have. It's called the Shared European, and I dropped the E for now, Environment Information System. But it sort of sits behind what I've been saying this afternoon, is that there is a move afoot across Europe that we move out of the world of charging for data, holding data, keeping it secure, and actually sharing it at source. And I have to admit that the success rate has been much higher than I thought it would be, even amongst the mapping agencies. I won't say anything about the Ordnance Survey, but all other mapping agencies across Europe are now working assuredly with us on the INSPIRE directive to make all of the mapping available, and I'll show you the outcome of it. We also have a phenomenal space program now, which is actually designed for us. Even though the space community thinks it's for them, actually, if you look at all the things that are up there, it's for us. But you wouldn't know it. There's 3 billion euros being invested. So I'm really saying to you, get involved, and let's really make sure that we get the best out of it, because these are really, really cutting-edge instruments that we now need to link to the ground. I know the land use community is well up there, but there's many other things that we can use it for. In particular, we're doing a lot of, you know, global to local measuring, and I know that you're kind of well-versed in all of that. But here's an application that we're running with farmers to do in-situ monitoring across Europe, really looking at water abstraction rates right down to individual field level, and it's on the basis of this that 5 countries have been able to issue their farmers with the checks promptly and on time, simply because they supplied this digitally. At sea, we have a similar kind of phenomena, lots of integrated monitoring, and more, what we're able to do is put very cheap sensors out, little carbon sensors and many other things which are able to monitor the world and bring that together in the space community. So, final bit, power to the people. I think that with these kind of rather sophisticated sensors and ways of looking at the world, we should be in the business of creating more and more citizens as observers. And I know in the UK, we have a lot of people involved in biodiversity, but there are very, very many opportunities in which people can participate in the creation of evidence and science. And to do that, we've created, together with colleagues, something called Eye on Earth. If you go to our website, you will see it. It is, in principle, the global platform that we'll use to support UNEP in the UNEP Live. And the American federal government and many of the states are going to come on board, or already are, and Canada and so on and so forth. What is it? Well, this is one picture. It looks like this for Europe. And all those dots are all the live monitoring stations for air quality and water. And wherever you go, you're able, because of the running of a model, which we now extend across the world, to get an updated every hour air quality measurement at surface. You can also have an SMS, which means that on your telephone you can be alerted for things like high ozone. 24,000 people prematurely die every year because of ozone in Europe, by the way, just in case you didn't know that. So ozone is not a great thing to have. Now, the reason this is important is because on the right-hand side, you'll see the little people. And the little people indicate where you can tell us what you think about air quality and what you think about water quality. And although we have a lot of skeptics around, it turns out that this is an incredibly effective way of testing whether our in-situ monitoring and our modeling is really working. So you can go right down to your house. I happen to live there. This is the beach where I swim every morning. And you can have all the time histories of data. You can do the same thing every hour for your air quality, and then you can rate the quality on that day. And you can share it with your friends, do whatever you want. What is really interesting is that when we do this crowdsourcing, we see that pretty much citizens do a very good job of telling us about air quality and water quality. And it's the combination of, you probably can't see it so well here, but the squares are the observations from the instruments, and the circles are from people. And I just took one slice, one time slice. What's really interesting is that 3 weeks ago, people were actually logging in certain places, rather poor air quality, but the instruments were saying it was all fine. And 2 days later, the instruments were saying this is really poor quality. And so, of course, this reminds me that this is the most sophisticated instrument on the planet for measuring air quality. So crowdsourcing is a huge potential for us to generate evidence in the near real time around the state of the environment. And this is really what we're promoting through the idea of mobile GIS technology. We've negotiated with Esri to have a $10 million budget to donate basically Esri products to every institution we work with, so you can create all of this on your telephones. So if you'd like to be one of those partners, I'm sure that can be arranged. And finally, just to say that in the collection of evidence and the creation of the knowledge for the natural capital, we launched yesterday the baseline and the biodiversity information system for Europe. And I think the breakthrough here was convincing the Commission and all our member states
that we should be encouraging citizens and many, many other groups, amateur taxonomists and others, to participate. And by doing that, we increased by an order of magnitude the amount of knowledge and information that we have already in the system. Soil still has a long way to go, I have to say, on biodiversity. But anyway, and just the idea that opening the doors, you have this avalanche of knowledge that can come in and can be quality assured, that's also possible. And so, you know, we're really now, I think, going again and again back to the idea of people telling stories, people providing knowledge and information. It's sitting in a much broader context, and that the governance of the environment through these stories, for example, this one, organic winemaking at a huge scale in Spain, belies the fact that we can't do certain things to change and green the economy. So it's about participation, but in the end, it's about evaluating evidence, but making sure there's transparency to deal with the complexity and the urgency and the ethics. And I think what we're calling for now is the possibility that across the Union, in every country, there should be a way in which we can have an independent platform or a source where people put all the evidence, but where they are obliged, as in a court of law, to declare their vested interests, whether you'll be a scientist or a company or whatever, and that we can see and understand the genesis of the knowledge and information that's actually being used to go into the policy-making machinery. Because as we know, they can either pluck it from the air or they can make it up. So with that, I will leave it. Thank you very much for your time.
Ice cream outside in a while, but first some questions. We have a short question session because I know Jackie has to leave fairly promptly at 3:30, and we'd like Jackie to have some ice cream as well. So there are a couple of questions. We have someone, I think Jenna has a microphone and Carol has a microphone, so are there any questions? Drennan. Microphone coming, Drennan.
Well, let's stand up, thank you. It's fascinating, but I've been involved a lot with NGOs, but also taught in universities in several countries in Europe. And when you see scientists trying to function in this situation, the thing that strikes me is they have to be able to see the whole system. The problem is scientific education, as we pursue it, is linear and narrower. And it's actually destructive of that capacity. And people come out of universities less able to do the job than when they went in. And it's almost because of the knowledge, and I'm quite serious about that. The other thing is that scientists misunderstand the role. I don't know if you've read the European Union report prepared for them by Funkevitz and Ravitz, in which they tackle this problem of complexity and scientists function and what they call second order science, which doesn't mean inferior. And I wonder if you'd comment on that. Thank you.
Very briefly, yes. I mean, I know Jerry, and they are actually authors in the Late Lessons volume. So just to be clear, and the second order science, I think you're exactly right. Whenever I use that phrase, that people get upset, so I tend never to use it. I think de-skilling is a real challenge because I having come from a university before this job, I see it again and again, particularly in mathematics and in the analytical sciences. But a place like this seems to me to be the counter to that, where you can have the opportunity as a PhD student, for example, to not be stuck into the chemistry department or the physics department or whatever. And I was delighted to see that there wasn't a single science discipline that I could identify from any one of those posters. So I think that's precisely the point. We should perhaps be doing more to have at least PhDs done in this kind of a setting, rather than having them done only in the disciplinary nexus that we currently find in most universities. But again, it's very, very hard to see in the short term how you get that analytical capability without necessarily having that concentrated time with people in their young age period to actually learn how to do it. So I have no easy answers, but I just think that certainly from the master's onwards, this is the kind of setting in which we should be taking students through.
Hi, thank you, David Elston. Yes, so your starting point, Jackie, was that you wanted more scientists to come in through your door and the door of other policymakers. It seems to me there's a fundamental conflict here, because I think that the people who come through your door and your colleagues are actually the people who have stories to tell. And yet the people that you most want to hear from are the independent scientists who aren't pushing particular cases. So how do you deal with that?
We actually take everybody, you know, like we take all the orphans and everybody else. But being more serious, I think that there's a way in which we try to constitute the scientific input to the agency and therefore on into the policy machinery, which means that we're forced by dint of the way in which we organize our gathering of evidence to confront many different scientific views. I'll give you one example. We have in our network, so the agency is rather small, it's only about 180 people, and then we're surrounded by about 2,000, 3,000 scientists who support us in our work. So in any one topic, there's a minimum of 50 scientists who are sitting in the room talking, let's say, biodiversity. Now, there are still big issues around, for example, hunting and a number of issues. So you can be absolutely sure that when we, by dint of our governance, bring in 50 scientists to discuss that, you don't actually end up with any one nation, culture, school, or discipline dominating. And actually, we spend a lot of time evaluating the evidence that's brought forward by each of those individual scientists, and also trying to understand how tightly they're tied into their national or ministerial setting. So I think in one sense, we see a way through this. And I think the storytelling just enhances an understanding. It gives a slightly more human aspect to it. But when I come to biodiversity and amateur groups, then I think you've got a very solid basis upon evidence gathering in the lichen area, for example, where you just will not get the density of observations if you were to rely solely on the scientific community. So for us, it's a balancing act. You know, it's no good having three observations from the best lichenologists in Europe and then disregarding the possibility of having 500 observations from a group of amateurs who are, you know, learning and getting improved and getting some kind of certification. So I think it depends on the subject, it depends on the status and the maturity of the science, and it also depends on the context in which we're bringing the science together.
Steve Alban. You commented a couple of times that there's a big social element in how influential science is. You also referred to valuation, particularly in the context of the TEEB exercise. I wasn't quite sure what you felt about that. I mean, there's quite a social science influence or collective on valuation. Is it that we're not currently adopting the right methods of valuation, or shouldn't we be going there?
Well, there are two schools in the economics of this. There's a sort of macroeconomist from Chicago who basically feel that if you get a utility function, you can put a value on it, you can put a price on it, and that you can scale it, so it's generalizable. And then there's another group, environmental economists, who tend to think in context. And they would be the ones who'd say, if you have, for example, a coral reef, and this piece is actually protecting a mangrove, and this area isn't, then that one is likely to be much more valuable than the one over here. So they get very much more down to the local scale and put valuation or pricing at that scale. And there's a kind of a difference between the one and the other. One is more statistical and very local, and the other is more generic and more macroeconomic. And at the moment, the macroeconomics generates the big numbers, the trillions, which are sometimes very hard to persuade politicians about. And on the other hand, the day-to-day job of governments is about the local, where you need good cost-benefit analysis, etc. So it's not that I don't believe in valuation, I just think it has a place, but it's not necessarily in the normal business of trying to look after the natural capital of a territory, for example, or a nation state.
Hi, Neil Sang. I'm a spatial analyst here. I wanted to ask you about the crowdsourcing. It's quite an interesting idea. When I was doing my undergrad degree, I had a lecturer called Stan Openshaw, who believed and argued passionately that he had a moral duty to do data mining in order to spot problems before we actually recognized them. Is the Environment Agency planning to do something similar with this huge amount of data you envisage collecting?
Well, before we start doing that, one area of data mining that's I think more potentially more relevant is about going through and creating a climate archive for Europe, because we don't have one at a regional scale. So what we will do is our first detailed data mining will be to generate a hindcast for 50 years and then data mine that. So there's a kind of sequence. But the data mining of the crowdsourcing is an ongoing exercise, really trying to test how effective it is. And as I said, on air quality, it seems we will do a big test this summer when we think the ozone and the heat waves will come through. So we really will be vigilant on that. Now we've had a first sight that it may be that the crowdsourcing gives us even 1 or 2 days notice before the instruments to give to public health officials. So that's a direct kind of application that we would look for. So I'd say the first hint that it is that it could work and give us an even earlier warning than we get from the instruments.
Zebedee, desperate to ask a question. Brian.
You talk a great deal about the kind of bias and the vested interests of much of the sponsors of research, which comes through as a theme through much of your presentation. What confidence do you have in the research which is being undertaken by people like IFAD, FAO, indeed your own organisation, the European Union, to come up with more objective and balanced research results which you would be more comfortable with?
Okay, let me just correct. We're not part of we're a part of the union, but not tied to its research machinery. So we're recipients of research. And that actually is a very important distinction, because the Framework 7, as it currently is programmed, is articulated on the basis of policy priorities. But they're the policy priorities of probably about four years ago, which was for Europe to become the most advanced economy in terms of efficiency, etc. And therefore, you can see that the kind of research that's being funded through the blue, the white platforms, the blue technology platforms, and so on, is very much driven by an agenda that was set some time ago, and actually was set by a particular group of scientists who were really consulted and had a very, very heavy influence on that. And there's very little opportunity, apart from the European research area and the council, for blue skies research at a European level, which I think is a shame, and I think it should be the case that we put more attention to that. So we are more users of research rather than actually producing research ourselves. However, more and more, because there's such a time delay in the research machinery, we do actually pinpoint areas where we don't have answers, and we try to find across the union and across the world people who can actually come together and actually start working to answer some of those. What we try to do to safeguard ourselves against the criticism I have put very firmly at many people's feet is to do precisely what I've described, bring all the various paradigm supporters of the different paradigms into a room and actually try to understand what the evidence is that they're working on. And we've done it for four areas. We did it for pesticides, we did it for BPA, we're doing it for GM right now, and we're doing it for a particular chemical that was one of the endocrine disruptors. And what's fascinating there is that we can find groups that have the same evidence and have absolutely opposite viewpoints about what to do about it. So we've brought them into a room, sort of Chatham House rule, and actually said, let's try and understand why you fundamentally disagree with each other when you're all using the same evidence. I'll give you one snippet of an answer. On the pesticides, in fact, in this country, the Royal Commission, and then there was the Agricultural Committee, I think, had exactly this problem. One said pesticide spraying was a problem, the other said not. And it turned out that why the Royal Commission actually found that it was ultimately a problem was because they added one more layer of information and knowledge, which was they sent a doctor, a medical doctor, to the local community and did a local survey and found out that there were very high instances of a number of medical problems that were caused because of dispersive spraying as pesticides. So when they put that on the table, then it became much clearer as to why they then read the evidence in a different way compared to their colleagues from the Agricultural Committee. So I think our job is very much to try to get that knowledge out into the open and make it very transparent before we then start to think about commissioning or looking at any other research. So we try to do that systematically all the time.
Okay, thank you very much. I think there's a couple of things remain before everyone dashes off to form an orderly queue for the ice cream. The first is to thank Jackie on everyone's behalf. This is a highlight of the year, this day, and indeed this week, and so we're very pleased that you've been able to come and speak to us. And those of you who've been to these before will know that we make travelling home on planes almost impossible by giving you a few things to mark the fact you planted a tree and gave us the lecture. So they're all under here. You've been actually lecturing near them. So you probably need someone else to take them away. First of all, there's a book. Which probably a bit heavy to put in your carry-on luggage. I'll take it away from you and give you the next thing. A very handy scroll with this year's shocking pink colour ribbon to note that, yes, you may. Yes, and someone at the back there with a very long telephoto lens is spying on us. So,
oh, wow.
If you look at David, he'll take your photo with
sorry.
And then... there's a quake as well, engraved, so you know what to do with that,
thank
I'm sure.
Of course.
And finally, the surprise that someone mentioned beforehand is your very own stick of Macaulayite.
Oh, great! So, oh, my God, this could be worth a fortune. Yeah, yeah. Especially if I found it on Mars. Oh my God.
So you went there. So thanks very
much.
It's been a pleasure having you here. So thanks very much. We'll have a seat for now. I'm sure Jackie won't mind, but there are a lot of other people who work very hard to make this week a success, and so we'd like to thank them. There's, of course, the caterers, the scientists who've been working with the posters, all the administrators and others who've been involved in organising and entertaining four sets of school kids. We'll have murder mystery microscopes for schools, the adult version, I guess, for tomorrow. We don't sanitise that since it's kids. And there's a Cayley, of course, tomorrow night. And Jane's not going to believe this, but every year we do have a lottery to embarrass the whole group by picking on someone to give them a bunch of flowers. And Jane Lund, who we all know in here is our events coordinator and supremo, manages a big team. And I know she's embarrassed by this, but Jane, would you like to come and accept this with all our thanks? Thank you all for coming. There remain 9 minutes for Jackie to get some ice cream and you to catch her out in the marquee. Look forward to seeing you outside, and thank you again for your attendance, and good to see you all here. Thank you.